We're at Quorum, so we will officially call this meeting to order. And if I could get Representative Murdoch, would you be willing to move the minutes? You would. You make that official, huh? Absolutely. Representative Murdoch moves the minutes. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion passes there. We got some minutes approved. Representative Mariani, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, yes, I would. I would like to move that House File 1666 be recommended to pass, and this can go straight to the floor amendment.
Representative Mariani moves that House File 1667 be recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill was brought forward by my school district, St. Paul Public Schools. It was brought forward last year. We actually passed this provision inside the K-12 omnibus policy bill as part of the conference agreements. As many of you know by now, that overall bill was vetoed by the governor. So there are a number of different provisions that you're seeing this year resurface in a number of different places. This is one of those provisions. And basically, what this does is it clarifies school district responsibilities for placing and transporting children with disabilities and children with without disabilities who are placed in care and treatment programs. And these programs, as many of you know, would include things like chemical dependency treatment, juvenile correction centers, programs for children with severe emotional and behavioral problems, and juvenile sex offender treatment programs. What the bill would do then was it would give resident districts, who are the districts that are responsible for the cost of these programs, their responsibility, it would provide them a say when a child is placed in care and treatment. You could have those placements ordered by court, for instance, and apparently there are times when that comes as a surprise, sort of after the fact, for school districts to know about that. It would allow the school district to have a say in terms of the placement choices. In the case of an emergency placement, it would allow for notice to be given within 15 days so that we're not holding up, you know, an emergency placement, and then the district would have 5 days to be able to respond in terms of that placement. And then finally, it would allow resident districts to establish some reasonable transportation restrictions. As members, as you all know, transportation is a huge cost. The districts obviously want to do the right thing, but it's very important that those districts have a say in terms of the cost that are then incurred by these placements. With that, Mr. Chair, I have Mary Gilbert from St. Paul Public Schools who can share a little bit more about why this is needed.
Great. State your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public School. Some of you may remember this from last year. This was passed and was part of the policy bill last year. As Representative Mariani said, the chair, that this is just an attempt to try and increase communication between schools, the courts, and parents when they're placing children in care and treatment, because school districts do have staff, and they want to be able to continue to work with the child when the child is in treatment. And we also made an exception that we worked out with the department to make sure that if the court places the parent and the parent doesn't have any choice in the court's placement, that the parent is not left kind of holding the hook for the transportation as well. So I think we've kind of covered all the bases to provide a reasonableness standard, but also to make sure, you know, that parents also are taken care of if the courts intervene. And the one other provision deals with the school closing provision. Oh, not in there anymore?
No,
okay. And the reason there's two sections is because sometimes a special ed student is placing care and treatment, so that's one section of the bill, and the second is that sometimes a parent or somebody else places a child in care and treatment, and that is not, chemical dependency is not a condition for special education. But because the transportation rules apply to both types of placements, that's why we're making the correction to, or the clarification to both.
All right, questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 1667 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Yes, and Representative Mariani, I believe you have another bill before us here.
Mr. Chair, members, I have House File 648. And I would move that House File 648 be recommended to pass, and this can go to the General Register as well. And, Mr. Chair, I have a 0114 amendment, 0114 amendment. I would move that amendment. At this point, this is a delete everything amendment.
All right. I hope all of you have the A0114 amendment before you. And as is customary, then, we will allow this to be taken to a vote to get it in the context that the author would like it to be. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the delete all is approved. Representative Mariani, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill basically would encourage this to include CPR and external defibrillation instruction as part of their curriculum. We're not mandating that they have it, but the importance of the bill is that if, in fact, schools are offering, willing to offer these life-saving techniques, then they must follow, by statute, then they must follow its instruction that, and there's some options here, instructions that, rather training that's provided by, and training rubrics provided by the American Heart Association or the American Red Cross, and then, or use nationally recognized evidence-based guidelines for both CPR external defibrillation training. So it's permissive in terms of what it expects school districts to do if they provide these services. However, it's explicit in terms of the guidelines, the evidence-based, high-standards guidelines as developed by either one of these organizations or as nationally recognized in an evidence-based construct. The amendment removed the rulemaking that was initially in the bill, and that was to reflect both the permissive nature of this, but also to remove the fiscal cost affiliated with the original bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I would ask my testifier, Ms. Sue Richter, to explain to the committee the need for the legislation and why it's important for us to be strongly encouraging the use of these well-developed training rubrics.
Thank you, Representative Mariani, and distinguished members of the Education Policy Committee. I'm very much appreciative of the opportunity to speak today. My name is Sue Richter. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Twin Cities Chapter of the American Red Cross, and I'm here representing all of the American Red Cross chapters in the state of Minnesota. The American Red Cross supports Minnesota House File 648, which encourages school districts to include cardiopulmonary resuscitation and automatic external defibrillator instruction as a part of their curriculum. More than 300,000 Americans suffer from sudden cardiac arrest each year, and less than 10% of them survive. Prompt administration of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, what we ordinarily call CPR, can help immeasurably. CPR increases cardiac victims' chances of survival by keeping the brain supplied with oxygen until the victim receives advanced medical care.
Without CPR, the brain will begin to die within 4 to 6 minutes. In more than two-thirds of all cardiac arrests, an electric shock known as defibrillation is needed. Numerous studies show that prompt CPR followed by early defibrillation can reduce deaths from sudden cardiac arrest. The greatest chance of survival from cardiac arrest occurs when the cardiac chain of survival happens as quickly as possible. The chain of survival includes early activation of the emergency medical system, EMS, in other words, dialing 911, and then immediate and prompt delivery of CPR, early defibrillation, and then advanced cardiac life support, most frequently in a post-incident care provided in a hospital setting. Weakness in any of these links lessens the chance of survival. I believe that HF-648 will have a positive effect on all residents of the state of Minnesota, and the Minnesota chapters of the American Red Cross support and strongly endorse HF-648. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak in support of this legislation.
Thank you. Representative Norna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I have right now, are all staff members trained in this procedure?
In the American Red Cross?
No. In the public school system.
In the public school system? I don't.
Is that required?
I don't believe it is.
Mr. Chair, this bill is addressing students, am I understanding that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I guess my follow-up question would be, it doesn't specify at what age level or grade level we're talking about. Is that open to Representative Mariana?
And members, this amends statute related to subject areas for which we have statewide accountability. This would be lodged within the locally developed academic standards for health and SCI-Ed, and those are locally developed standards, and within the requirement then of school districts having to provide for health and physical education, we identify CPR, and I don't know what the abbreviation is, EDI?
AED.
AED, CPR and AED training as part of what's committed within those health and physical education standards to be met. And then if in fact districts then wish to offer those, then the statute is explicit about the kind of training that would then be the proper training to be offered within that office.
Thank you.
Other questions for members? Representative Faust?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I think you mentioned that the American Red Cross would be sending people in to do the training. Is that right? And would they provide the machines that are needed? Because some of those, I think, are fairly expensive, and I just want to make sure that the schools aren't on the hook to pay for all of that, those types of things. So if you can answer that, I appreciate it.
I'll certainly have a stricter answer to the availability, or to speak better, rather, than to the issue of availability of machines. Again, there's no mandate to that's being created here to provide CPR and AED training, in which case then I would think that this issue would come very much to the forefront to have that, you know, that equipment available. But in the event that districts that in fact wish to do this, I would imagine that the need and the use of that equipment would be part of that consideration of the district opting to offer this. I don't know if you can stick to the availability of the equipment, the schools, and
all of our Red Cross chapters throughout the state do provide the CPR training. I can't speak to exactly what the relationship is between every single school district, but I do know between the American Red Cross and the American Heart Association, it would be a safe assumption that the school districts would be covered in some way. There is a cost for the materials, and there's also a cost for AEDs, the defibrillators. And I don't know what the legislation is in the state of Minnesota for requiring AEDs in each school, but certainly we do have courses that teach people the proper use of those life-saving machines.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know.
Yeah, we are unaware if there are any requirements as of this time in statute. Representative Newton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to get back to Representative Norna's question, a lot of schools don't have trained people. We just in an Okanagan put AEDs in all of our schools, and in the process found out that some of our high schools with 3,000 students only have two or three people that are Red Cross trained to do CPR, which isn't much. One of the issues is the cost. It's the individual teachers, if they want to be Red Cross certified, have to pay a fairly substantial fee for that. AEDs can cost anywhere from $1,400 to $3,000 a piece. If you make this a part of staff development, maybe for teachers, that some of those funds could be used. That was something that we explored. But I think we're getting in an area where it could be a substantial cost, especially to smaller school districts. And one of the questions I would have is whether, ask Representative Mariani if he would consider permitting local police departments or fire departments to do the instruction rather than having teachers certified.
Mr. Chair and members, a couple of issues. Again, I think it's probably a good idea. This, however, only speaks to the issue of school districts that wish to offer this instruction within their locally developed standard here. So I would imagine that school districts would be factoring into that decision the both availability, I would imagine, availability of tools and instruments, as well as the nature of the training that the nature of the training level that exists within the schools. We obviously want to make sure that if training is happening at all in this critical life-saving procedure, that it would be proper training. So think about this. I would say think of this as sort of baby step toward hopefully what would become, in my mind, a long-term goal on our part to be able to avail ourselves of the fact that we have young people in schools to be able to universally have training for these kinds of procedures. You heard the numbers, in terms of the numbers of people per year that suffer cardiac arrest. I don't think there's anything in here that would bar any of our local emergency responders to be able to play a role. I think that's really left to either community dynamics, programming, or any kind of arrangements that can be made with the school district. Obviously, to the degree that this language prescribes that they be following these high standard procedures, I would assume that those local emergency responders would meet those kind of standards. I'm told that on another issue, I'm told that there apparently, and I'm not aware of this, apparently there's a bill that's I think more moving in the Senate that would open up teacher training opportunities for youth in particular, that this kind of instruction would be eligible for teacher, for staff development, professional development dollars.
Other questions from members? Representative Getsy.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, you kind of answered my question, which was why did you choose to put it into the classroom rather than having it be more something at the teacher continuing education level, which would be, in my mind, it would be a good start. But I think you could explain why you chose to go the other route. Please, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, it's basically, frankly, trying to take a healthy opportunity of the fact that we do have health and physical education standards that our students are required to meet. Again, those are locally developed standards. Those aren't state standards, and so we're not directing that standard must include this instruction, but if it does include this instruction, then what I'm looking for is the state to say that it should follow these high standards of training, and I think that's an appropriate level given that we're dealing with life-saving procedures.
Thank you, Representative Mariani.
Any other questions from members? Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment that I would like to propose that you consider, Representative Mariani, and that's on line 1-6, where it reads automatic external defibrillator instruction as part of their curriculum, and then follow that with and to seek the cooperation of local law enforcement officials of local law enforcement officials providing the instruction, or excuse me, local law enforcement officials or emergency medical technicians, EMT, in providing the instruction. I should let Ms. Larson go just to make sure. But the objective is to make sure that the schools know that they can avail themselves of these services, and they don't have to look internally for people to give the instruction.
Mr. Chair, I would consider that a friendly amendment.
One second, we'll get the official language here. Lisa Larson will read the official language here for us.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the document A09-0114, on page 1, line 6, after the word curriculum, insert, and to seek the cooperation of trained local law enforcement officials or emergency medical technicians in providing the instruction.
Mr. Chair,
questions from members? Oh, Representative Mariani?
I was just going to repeat that I would consider that a friendly amendment.
Representative Byner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, since Representative Mariani has said he considers it a friendly amendment, I say this with reluctance, but it's really a question to the amendment's author. It says it doesn't say that they're open to seeking. It says they will. It says to seek. So my concern is that if they already have something in place that's working and it's internally provided, why should they need to go outside to check with law enforcement? So this is more of a directive than an opportunity, and I have a concern about that.
And so the terminology there, and two, you could replace two with may. Representative Newton, how do you feel about that language?
That's correct. That would be better. And that's, you know, it is permissive. We want them to have that as an option.
Mr. Chair, that would still be a friendly amendment. Friendlier.
And just to clarify, it is amending the delete all 0114 on line 1.6. Any other questions or comments from members? Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is more of a general question, maybe directed at Representative Mariani. Is there a particular problem that we're correcting with this? It feels like we're getting pretty prescriptive, and I don't disagree with, you know, having the Heart Association and the Red Cross do the skills and that sort of thing. Is this a decision that school districts themselves are making to not do? Are they making decisions to not be instructed? Are they... you know, are they not consulting with locals? I mean, is this a decision that we have to inform them about? And I'm just, and how will we inform them that they know that they have to be doing these things now? I'm just, personally, I agree with it. If I was the school board or if I was, you know, the administrator working this, these are the type of things I would be doing. I'd say, this is how we should do that. Why do we have to tell them that from here?
Representative Demmer, is this to the amendment or is this to the...
This is to the, I'm sorry, are we voting on an amendment?
Yeah, there is an amendment right now before us.
Oh, I thought you incorporated that. I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry. That's
okay.
It's on the bill.
Okay. Any comments to the amendment? All right. Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote on the amendment on the 0114 on line 1.6 to include and may seek the cooperation of trained local law enforcement or EMT in providing the training, correct? The instruction, excuse me. Local law enforcement officials or emergency medical technicians in providing the instruction. Those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and it is amended.
Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Chair, I suppose that I represent Denver's question, I guess, that is before us. I'm told that we don't have an accounting, if you will, survey anything in terms of which and how many school districts. I'll pursue that. I think it's a really good question, but my understanding is that there's a patchwork, that some are and some aren't, and so the language here is really meant to be an encouragement to all districts to pursue and to do it not in a way where we're, you know, mandating, but providing some guidance in terms of what we would expect would be the high standards then that are would be affiliated with this kind of training.
Representative Demmer, any follow-up?
At not.
Any other questions from members? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to make light of this, but I've just kind of been visiting in my mind requiring high school students to practice mouth-to-mouth. Is this going to be a problem?
They do it now.
I'm
sorry, Mr. Chair. Practice enough to what?
You lined up in the hallway.
It's part of this training, mouth to mouth.
Ah, yes.
What I would say is that the techniques that are used, the training techniques, are not from person to person, but are on mannequins. And so in order to get the right techniques, you have to practice. And it really would not be safe to try to do that person to person.
Okay. I feel better. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I could have gotten a lot of trouble with that. So.
Yes, you could have. Any other questions for members? Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, and members, any other further discussion? All right, Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 648 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the General Register. Those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members. Members, next on the agenda is House File 751, Representative Benson. And Representative Benson, there is a related bill to this House File 981, but we've not talked through about how to handle this. They are distinctive bills, but they are related. I leave it to your guidance and suggestions on how we might want to have the conversation. We can either do it the traditional way, just to hear one bill and then take action and hear the other, or if you think it's important to hear them, or perhaps to hear testimony simultaneously, and then we can go back. I don't want to confuse the committee, but I know there's an interrelatedness here. Perhaps the simplest thing might be for you to reference House File 981, and then we can decide as we get into the testimony how we would take action on the bill. But I just wanted to offer invitation that if you think it would be helpful to have Representative Bly join you with House File 751, that the chair is certainly open to that possibility.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it might work better, however, if we do them one after the other.
Very well. Let's do that. Representative Benson moves that House File 751 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the committee or to the Finance Committee with a re-referral recommendation to the K-12 Finance Committee. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also have a delete all.
Representative Benson has a delete all amendment. It is A090195. Representative Benson would move the 0195 amendment. And so this is shaping the bill up in the manner in which you wish to have it before us. Members, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Benson, your bill is before us in the way of which you wish to have it presented.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members. If it would be all right with the chair, we have one presenter who, because of pressure back in his home district, time pressure, it would be useful if I could ask him to come forward and just make a few brief comments
before
he has to leave.
Very well. If the witness can come forward.
I'd like to introduce Superintendent Rick Gresson, Superintendent of the Edina Schools. Unfortunately, I'd already retired from school from that district before this excellent new superintendent took charge. But I'm sure the school district is doing fine even without me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson, I'm sure that's a stretch, but knowing the quality of Edina staff members, I'm sure they're working hard to meet the standards that you left behind.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Superintendent Dressing, good morning. It's a pleasure to have you.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you very much. Representative Benson, thank you. For the past 28 years, I've had the honor of serving Minnesota as an educational administrator in private education, urban education, a second-ring suburb, a greater Minnesota community, and now a suburban setting. My journey has enabled me to view learning in our classrooms and the evolution of our educational system, which is responding to the challenges and the opportunities of a dynamic world. My journey has taught me that our state and local communities place a high value on our young people and their education. And going forward, we need everyone's support and efforts to ensure that all of today's students will be successful 21st century educated citizens. This is where you come in as elected officials. I believe our state and our schools in all locations throughout the state need your help in challenging our current educational system to be bold with innovation. In 1862, President Abraham Lincoln, in his annual message to Congress, shared a message that rings true to us today. He stated, "Still the question recurs, can we do better? The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so now we must think anew and act anew." The educational programs and initiatives proposed in this legislation would allow communities throughout the state of Minnesota to think anew and act anew and bring greater success to students. Creativity and innovation must be key elements in the educational plans of our state's future. I encourage you to support this legislation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Dressing. Any questions or observations from committee members before Mr. Dressing leaves? If not, Dr. Dressing, I know you're pressed, but I certainly would invite you to linger as long as you may, and perhaps there may
I will
be
stay and I will monitor as long as I can, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. There may be questions that arise as we proceed. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Superintendent. Well, I'd like to, first of all, start by thanking the co-authors of this bill, if I may, including Representative David Bly, who we know will be presenting a companion bill in a few minutes. Also, Representative Dabney, Peterson, Riley, Downey, and Slocum. So thank you all for your support of this reform bill, which I hope will become part of our new Minnesota Miracle 2 K-12 Finance and Reform Bill. I'm going to curry favor wherever possible. And it works.
It's been quite effective for you.
So before my first testifier, Mr. Kurt Johnson, walks us through the bill, I'd like to just kind of frame the discussion a little bit. As we all know, there is a continuing and growing critical debate on the reforming of the American public school system, usually centered on calls for greater accountability, choice, and competition. And all these three, of course, are important aspects towards moving our public school system to a better place. But House File 751 does address these issues, but it does in a little different way and comes at it a little different direction, because it focuses on a fourth and possibly central concern, in my opinion, which is the human capital component. And central to everything that happens in the schools, eventually, revolves around what is going on in the classroom between the teacher and the students. And one of the interesting things to me as I've watched this debate about educational reform is how little time really has been spent on the issue of the human capital component, as I call it. That is, the job of teaching. What happens in the classroom? The people who are meeting the students every day and are the ones that can make such a big difference. And we know this is a critical issue because the numbers of people who enter the profession now is reaching a critical mass in the sense that many, too many, are leaving within 3, 4, or 5 years. And many of these people are exactly the kind that we do not want to lose. So this House bill, in part, concentrates on doing something to improve the role of teachers in the classroom. I want to go on and mention to you and make sure it's understood that this bill contains no mandates, either funded or unfunded. It establishes a voluntary process which puts into statute permission, which in a sense does already exist, but many schools and the teachers who work there are not aware of it, or because it is not in statute, are sometimes reluctant to move forward. But it allows and gives permission to groups of teachers to make proposals directly to the school boards to create a new school, while still staying employees of the district, remaining members of their union, and while they continue to receive their negotiated benefits. This is a very important aspect of this bill. The bill spells out what autonomy would mean. And we know that in the private sector, the most successful businesses in America are those that provide a space for real ownership of the work by their employers. And we know that this has led to dramatic increases in worker productivity, excellence, and satisfaction with their work. And this bill provides the vehicle to do the same for classroom teachers. In my own personal experience in Edina, before this superintendent came, we had a superintendent who was particularly interested in empowering teachers. He encouraged my colleagues and I to create a new learning model, which we did. We worked like demons to make sure that this new system succeeded, because we had personal ownership in the project. But I also know the deflation that comes to teachers when suddenly this ownership is taken away, or when support is withdrawn, in spite of the fact the students may be producing excellent high score tests on the College Board test, for example, which was something that happened to my colleagues and I. One or two of these disappointments in the life of a new teacher many times is enough to convince them they should leave the profession and go elsewhere where their talents are more valued. But school districts also have a great advantage, and that's why many school districts are supporting this proposal, because it has that ingredient to incentivize teachers to propose new programs. And this gives the school districts a competitive advantage in this era in which we see increasing competition in the marketplace. So to summarize, Mr. Chairman and members, this bill offers school boards and teachers a new straightforward process that encourages innovation while leaving undisturbed the traditional programs that continue to work well for 60% or more of the students and their teachers, but at the same time offering every teacher a real professional incentive to innovate. We call it, I guess, the split screen idea. We have new opportunities, but we do not disturb the traditional school, which for many people works fine. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce my first testifier, Mr. Kurt Johnson, if he would come forward. And I'm sure you all know Mr. Johnson. He was former Governor Arne Carlson's Chief of Staff. Mr. Johnson also served on the Met Council as chair. So Kurt Johnson, along with a great group of civic-minded individuals, formed the Reform Advocacy Group Education Evolving, a group that I've had great pleasure to get to know and to work with starting this last summer. Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Mr. Johnson. It's a pleasure to have you in our committee this morning.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Kurt Johnson with Education Evolving, and I'm pleased to be here in support of Representative Benson and House File 751. And at his encouragement, I may offer first just very few remarks in preface to the walkthrough of the bill. First, to say why this is an important step to take, maybe even a necessary step, and one that keeps a good tradition alive for the Minnesota legislature. Almost 40 years ago, Minnesota made state financing of education a big deal. So big it got branded as the Minnesota miracle. In the 1980s, you began to be serious architects of a schooling system, starting on the demand side, introducing post-secondary options, and soon after, full choice for parents and students in the public system. In 1991, you started working on the supply side of the equation, making it possible for new schools to be created outside the school district sector, chartered on an implied contract to deliver results in exchange for flexibility. This bill represents the next big opportunity for policy change. House File 751 focuses on the district sector where most of the kids are. It is an opportunity bill. For school superintendents and boards, it's an opportunity to create new learning opportunities that reach out to kids who are put down or turned off by the dominant school model, to allow willing teachers and parents to create schools they believe will succeed with these kids we are now losing. For school boards, it's a response, you might say, to chartering envy, a chance to create schools that will enjoy the same flexibility as the chartered sector does now. And as Representative Benson has said so well, it's an opportunity for teachers. We continue to lose at least 40% of the new teachers, and when surveyed, they consistently say it's not the money, it's that these 21st century young teachers find that it's not a very good job. Surely there are hundreds, maybe thousands of teachers who, if they could take responsibility for a school, would jump at the chance to have control over their work just like other professionals do. And you will hear from a teacher representative in a moment. And for parents and their kids, what is more desperately needed than a wider variety of learning options? Given how many different types of intelligence and learning styles kids have, how could we possibly imagine that the standard approach will line up with every student? It never has, it still does not. Creating new and fundamentally different schools within the district model actually is already something of a national movement. Boston has over a decade of experience with pilot schools. Chicago has aggressively created new schools and closed its weakest for nearly that long. Los Angeles is seeing pilot schools replace the worst schools it has in the Belmont area. And Denver now is embarking on this same course. But our point here this morning, members, is no state so far. No state has made this a state policy, and that's the opportunity here. Now, some people say quickly that this will be risky. Allowing teachers and parents to create different kinds of schools and giving them autonomy over how they operate? Well, sure, everything these days is a risk. But the biggest risk of all is doing the same thing we've been doing over and over, sticking with the status quo regardless of results, and avoiding the adventure of letting K-12 become a truly innovative enterprise. With Representative Benson, we would now propose, Mr. Chairman, to briefly walk through the subdivisions of the bill.
Very well, Mr. Benson.
The first subdivision, as we both said, offers superintendents and school boards the opportunity to request proposals for the kinds of schools they would like to see created and it invites any group of licensed professionals and parents to suggest a new school. The language builds on the school-based management statute as amended by you in 2005. It further specifies how variations in collective bargaining contracts can be recorded in memoranda of understanding, and it calls for what the bill terms an agreement to be forged between the district board and the school through a site governing council that makes clear what the roles and responsibilities are. In subdivision 2, and we would suggest to you, Mr. Chairman, this is a key section, it spells out the authority of those proposing to run a new school, including creating the site governing council, determining the leadership model, determining the budget for the school, deciding on the learning model the school will use, whether it's traditional or online or project-based or whatever, setting policies ranging from higher graduation requirements to length of school day and year, and the manner in which teachers and other staff are selected. On teacher selection, it is clear that the school will draw from available and willing teachers within the district. It's equally clear that the district remains the legal employer of all staff and that teachers retain their rights to union membership and benefits. This subdivision further spells out the main sources of revenue. This is subdivision 3 I'm talking about now, Mr. Chairman. Spells out the main sources of revenue, assuring that they arrive in proportion to the number of students generating that revenue. Districts can negotiate into the agreement an administrative fee to cover a fair share of district overhead costs, plus a share of such costs as facilities maintenance and special education. Subdivision 4, in addition to the autonomy within the district, this subdivision makes clear that these new schools are exempt from, as well as subject to, the same laws as specified in statutes governing chartered schools. Subdivision 5, this is an attempt to spell out what performance standards might look like. If schools are going to be judged only on their results, then what results? This subdivision contemplates that agreements will set forth a means of judging student achievement and criteria to follow if student achievement is not adequate. The agreements would be set up for up to 3 years, reviewed annually, and expanded to 5-year terms based on performance. The final subdivision, Mr. Chairman, specifies the conditions for terminating the agreement between a district and a school. Termination must be under this bill for good cause, having to do with violations of law or failure to live up to the provisions of the agreement. Termination for any other reason triggers the right of the school to convert to charter status.
Thank you. We do have some questions. Before we do that, or the chair has some questions, and Mr. Johnson, you and I had an opportunity to visit last week along with Representative Benson and Representative Bly. So the questions I had at the time were pressing you to make distinctions between this proposal and both our existing charter school laws that construct how charter schools can be created. Right. And then also our existing laws in regards to site-governed schools. So in other words, both of those creatures are now possible creatures within Minnesota reality. And so when my first blush at looking at the proposals here was, we already have this. So I imagine it's probably a question for many members as well. So perhaps if you can help us to make some important distinctions if they're there relative to existing law and what's being proposed here, and what is the value added, if you will, that we're looking for by this proposal.
So Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson and I have discussed this several times because this is really at the heart of the motivation that he had for introducing this bill. Certainly it's clear that any school district could go the charter route, and some indeed are doing that as we speak. But there is a kind of, if I may term it this way, a sort of a cultural aversion that many have to doing that. Having seen charters as a competition out there for over a decade, the idea of going that route is not the first thing that a lot of school districts, school boards, and teachers think about. So they were looking for something different. the law that you amended in 2005 simply set a process in statute. It didn't do anything to make explicit how that process might play out, and it only addressed the possibility of converting existing schools and required a 60% vote of teachers, licensed professionals, in order to move that along. The reason why that's seen as inadequate by Representative Benson at this point is that it doesn't open the possibility of creating new, fundamentally different kinds of schools from scratch. So that's really at the heart of this, and the state's interest is really to kind of set the table so that you get as many innovative schools and you widen the number of learning opportunities out there just as much as you can. That's what we think the value added is.
And I might add, you know, if...
Representative Bush.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it had been discovered that there was a fit-all model for all students, it would have been discovered long ago and implemented. We know that's not the case. So the opportunity here is to make it easier within traditional school districts to create incentives for teachers who wish to make some change, but do not wish to leave their union or leave their local district, but to stay within the confines of that district. The districts have an incentive to participate because many districts are constantly being faced with these competitive pressures from public schools or charter school, private schools or charter schools, and we're in a competitive market in education now, something I favor. And so it does that, but it does one other really critical thing to me. And I say this from my experiences of having taught for 35 years in the Edina schools. It concentrates on this issue of the human capital I was mentioning before. It provides an opportunity for classroom teachers who are willing to take the chance, willing to step out and work like devils to put a new program for kids they know are not being reached. Give them an opportunity to have ownership. We are an ownership society, and for a classroom teacher to know that he or she is going to put out all this extra effort, working night and day and weekends and during summer vacations and winter breaks to write the curriculum and really concentrate on this, there ought to be some guarantee for those persons that this experiment that they are going to embark themselves on has some parameters within which they know they can operate and they have some autonomy. This is extremely important in public schools. But at the same time, I remember having some of these programs that some colleagues and I introduced in the Edina schools, and I can't tell you how many times people would walk up to me and say, "You must not have much to do, Benson. You're always coming up with these new things all the time. Why are you doing that? You're making us look bad." Now, that kind of atmosphere, unless you've been a teacher in the public schools, is a very debilitating atmosphere, and everyone in here who is taught in the classroom knows exactly what I'm talking about. And so this is an opportunity to break out of that, but at the same time to respect all our colleagues who are still in the traditional mode, because they are successful. 60% of the kids, as I said, are successful, and they like the present system. It works for them, but for that 30 or 40% of teachers, those agitators, those people are always causing trouble. This is an opportunity for them to break out. And so that's, I think, the heart of it for me. For the public schools, it gives them another tool to be competitive in the marketplace of educational innovation.
Very well. We have three members of the committee, four, who have questions.
And we do have a couple other testifiers.
You do. All right. So let's do these four questions. Let's hear from the other testifiers, and then we'll get back to questions. We still have Representative Blythe, as well, to go through. Representative Newton, Obermueller, Reinert and Depke, and I'll stop there, but I'll come back to the other members after the other testified. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief. I really like this idea. And it seems to me that in our district, where we're going to be closing schools because of declining enrollment, that this gives us an opportunity to use those schools that would otherwise sit empty to have specialty programs, whether it's an IB program or an arts program or whatever, to draw students and teachers that want to work in those schools in. And I just think it's a great opportunity for us. The question I have, it has to deal with the funding. Would we be able to capture the lease funding that the charter schools get to you know, pay the district for the school?
Mr. John, Representative Benson or Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Newton, as you know, money in general is a radioactive subject in this body right now, and we rather deliberately chose to postpone the implications of the revenue, even though the cost of this entire program, including the companion bill that you will lately hear, is very small. The bundle of revenue that the chartered sector gets is a different mix from the ones contemplated here. The intent of this bill, though, is to level the field as much as possible, to make it as equitable as possible for the district sector to be innovative and create completely new schools and enjoy a stream of revenue that will support that. It's comparable to what the charter sector gets. But the sources have different names, and they vary a little bit in amounts. I don't think that will end up being very controversial at the end.
Thank you.
Representative Obermueller, and then Representative Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have two questions. I think they're pretty quick. The first is the money carries forward from year to year that's given to the school districts. Is it your intention that that money stays with the school if it converts to a charter school? And then the second one is sort of related to that. I'm a little, if you could address on lines 4.5 and 6, whether it's only a school board that can charter after conversion, or if the equipment and materials simply don't go with the school if it is chartered or authorized, I should say, by someone else.
Well, on the first one, and then maybe you take the other. The first one, that issue isn't really addressed in this bill, again, partly because we're presenting this before the policy committee, and we thought it might be better if we leave those financial issues, which we have, you know, contemplated for K-12 finance. And for the other.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative, it may not be as clear as it needs to be what that choice is at the end if the school did convert to a charter. The intent of the language in front of you was to make it clear that if the school board were to convert it to a chartered school, that it would own all of the capital equipment that was involved. It may leave open the question as to whether, if it becomes a completely independent charter, whether the stuff would go with the school. And I think that would probably be the intent.
And members, while we're not the finance committee, which means that I would encourage us not to get too deep in the weeds of finances, I think it's absolutely appropriate for members to ask what the intent is behind any of the revenue finance-related issues. Obviously, it's often difficult to disentangle intent from design or finance intent from design proposals. They go hand in hand. So it's certainly appropriate to raise this question. Representative Reiner and Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll preface my questions / comments by saying that the Mankato Public School District has done this thing. We have a 10-year-old school that we consider a research and development site that pretty much meets all the parameters here. The staff, there's a site council, you know, they make their own determinations about their structure, other than the length of school day and year, which is problematic when it comes to transportation. But that's another question, because your language is permissive more than directive. but I guess my questions are, and I might need a little more time to review, you know, think about the detail here, but have you run this by any schools that have done this to see if you're really being overly restrictive or if you're open-ended enough? Because I have a question about what, for instance, what the relationship is between the school board and these sites, because the school board is still the elected body responsible by law for these schools. And if it's simply contractual, you know, I have a little difficulty with that, because I think there has to be some real effective dialogue in terms of the community ownership and involvement there of the public voice. So my questions are more about flexibility and review, and you know, what you, who's looked at this and what you've heard back from people.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beinert, I think this goes to what Representative Benson said in his opening remarks, that if we want a different performance out of a bunch of willing teachers and staff, we're going to have to give them more responsibility than we do today, more authority. And the law needs to spell out the degree of autonomy that they can enjoy. Certainly that presents a different relationship between a school board and that school. But what the school board is doing is saying, we're making an agreement and we expect you to live up to it. And we're going to judge you by the results you get. And if you don't get those results, we're going to shut you down. In some respects, that enjoys more clarity than the traditional relationship, in which the school administration is trying to tell everybody what to do every day about everything, and then everybody's sort of accountable and nobody is. In a way, there's a lot more accountability in this arrangement, if you can see it that way.
Representative Epke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, my question is not exactly the same as Representative Reiner's, but I did want to ask you, have you discussed this with the Minnesota School Board Association? Because of the oversight issue and the ultimate decision-making authority that we are maintaining with our school boards, which I think is proper, where do they stand on that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Benson and Representative Bly and members of Education Evolving have actually had numerous discussions with all of the major education organizations, the School Boards Association. They made a number of suggestions for language changes, and I think we managed to accommodate most, if not all, of them. We've met with groups of superintendents from rural Minnesota and from suburban part of the metropolitan area. The enthusiasm you heard from Rick Dressen is pretty typical. It is even more pronounced, I think, on the part of superintendents who are presiding over fragile districts with declining enrollment, who are nearly desperate to figure out some way to create a richer variety of schools within their district. They're losing them to online, they're losing them to project-based schools, losing them to charters, losing them to neighboring districts. We've talked with Education Minnesota, had a good dialogue with them, and have been trying to satisfy any concerns that they may have about it. We did talk with the School Administrators Association. I think we have covered those bases. I'm not pretending that we satisfied everybody on everything, but we've tried to make sure that it's a realistic bill that everybody could live with.
Members, it's probably a good segue. I'm a little nervous about time. Representative Benson, you said you had some other testifiers. Let me suggest that because I think we also want to hear from other people in the public on this bill. Let me suggest that if we go deep into your bench of testifiers, we're going to have to lay this bill over till later in this week. And I it's looking like we're not going to get to the next bill on the agenda at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we were aware of the time constraints, and so our testifiers are going to speak quickly and to the point, and then we'll move forward.
And we still have four questions from members left on the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Representatives. Really thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm Lynn Nordgren. I'm the president of Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. And I'm here to say that I support this bill because I think it gives us a more solid foundation to work from as teachers. That we have been told for a long time what to do, how to do it, when to do it, by all the rules that are placed before us by both federal, state, and local entities. And it is interesting to me that for the 33 years that I have been a teacher and a teacher leader, and that I have found that teachers are often the last to be asked about what's best for kids. The rules are made, the staff development is created, the textbooks are purchased, and then the teachers are told what to do. And yet, it is the teachers who are the first on the line with the kids, with the students. It is absolutely time for teachers' voices to be considered the experts. We have just recently found out a lot of things about our own school district, and I'm not here to cast aspersions on my school district. I've been there 33 years. I'm not here to cast aspersions on the union. I'm its president now. Of course I believe in it. But I do believe in continuous improvement. And I think that there are ways in which we can change a lot of things in education and still work shoulder to shoulder to make it happen. It is absolutely time for this to happen. I feel like this bill provides more specificity. It helps give teachers more confidence in stepping forward. The other bill was fine, but I did bring it to other teachers, and they went, I really don't know what to do with this. And am I still in the union or not? Am I still in the district or not? Who's going to be there after we create the school so we get money to plan it? Then what? Am I going to get in trouble for doing this? And so this just actually gives us a solid footing to work from. I also have had the opportunity to be in a self-governed school for 3 years. It lasted 5. It was an incredible opportunity. We brought students out of the bottom quartile of testing within the first year, and in the second and third year, we emptied out the second quartile and moved almost everyone into the third. Most students came to us in the bottom quartile and had major behavior issues. By being able to, as teachers, create the kind of school that worked for these kids, for the kids that needed us to be able to be there for them in whatever way we needed to be, that's how it worked. It worked because the teacher became the expert in the school. So I really, and I agree that we need to also start drawing our families back. While I would argue that 60% of education works for some kids, I think all of education needs some change. This will give us an opportunity to see what those changes can be. So I'd like to draw more families back into our school district. I'd like to have students be more excited about coming to school and allowing their voices to also be heard. So I am very strong about the support of this bill, and I hope that you agree with me. And I'd like to say that we work like angels, not devils. And I was not a troublemaker, although you might define me as that. I was a teacher leader, and we have many strong teacher leaders who want to step forward and have this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Norgren. Representative Benson, is there anyone else that you have to testify to know? I want to try to get our testimony in.
All right. Very quick. Thank you.
Well, we can. Thank you, Ms. Norgren. We do think our teachers are angels in our state.
I will amend my comment. It's just something the administrator told me one day when he was upset with another idea that we were proposing.
You. Good morning, Mr. Graswald.
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Graswald, representing Minneapolis Schools. We support the bill strongly. We'd like to encourage you to let us innovate within the schools, working as partners with our teacher leadership, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, just out of respect for time.
Thank you. Greatly appreciate it. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on the bill in the audience? Mr. Bartholomew? And then we have 4 questions, and I think we may be able to get a vote in here, Ms. Representative Benson. Mr. Bartholomew, if you can be most precise and quick with your time, I appreciate it.
Will do. Mr. Chair and members, Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and we're very supportive of this legislation, and not to repeat everything that's been said, but I think the main reason is this allows our school districts, our school boards, the opportunity to tap into the expertise of the frontline people, the teachers in our schools. And in part, in answer to your question earlier, Mr. Chair, I think this legislation kind of reflects the learnings that we've had over the last 4+ years with current law. And I think the site-based
statutes in many ways create a continuum of opportunities from operating a full school to maybe pieces along the way, a different pieces, I mean, operations of the school. And that's kind of the current law. It kind of assumes that continuum. While this is more of a group of teachers and autonomous schools, as opposed to, you know, a piece of the operation. So I think this really reflects a lot of the learnings that have gone on. And one of
thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Members, we do have four questions from members. I don't see anyone else in the audience, but if anyone else wishes to testify, just work your way forward to the front of the room. Representative Loon and Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Representative Benson for spearheading this. I am really excited about this idea. I think it is holds phenomenal promise for our school, something I wholeheartedly endorse. I'm trying to think, though, through some of the practical implications of a school district, and I, again, personalize it, thinking about my own in Eden Prairie, of trying this out. And my assumption is some districts may look at maybe one site, you know, is giving this a run if it were enacted. And so for you or Mr. Johnson, whoever appropriate, or perhaps even the teacher, Ms. Organ, who testified, if this were tried, and I assume from reading the bill, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that there's a lot of latitude in determining kind of what that site would look like, and you would open it up to staff within the entire school district to join up with this site to do this kind of innovative approach. I'm a little concerned about cherry picking that would be perceived by parents, that kind of, you know, the really innovative teachers are going to all go to this one site. And when you've got a large district with boundaries in that, how do you, is there any guidance for sort of managing, if you will, parents who all are going to want their kids to go to this? And we've tried some innovative things, you know, with we've got a Spanish immersion school and some other things. And, I mean, it was much more popular than even the board determined. I think it was more than double demand from day one when they tried that. So what guidance are you going to give to schools who want to try this, but to try to manage the demand as the idea grows?
Yeah, we'll make
an excellent question, Representative Benson. We do have, as my observation over time, that the society does have a tendency to segregate ourselves and isolate ourselves, intending well, but sometimes creating unintended consequences of winners and losers across the social landscape.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative. This is a nice problem to have, first of all. And what we want to create is a situation in which there are so many wonderful options that the parents are going to be just busy trying to decide which would be the best option for their kids. Now, in the Edina schools, it was traditional. I don't know about other districts, but I only taught in one district my entire career. So I'm, you know, a neophyte on how some of these districts work. But Edina Schools had an option for parents to be able to request teachers. And at one point I had suggested that would be a great idea. We just put up our name tag somewhere and the parents and the students come in and interview us, and if we like them and they like us, they would all come into my class and I'd hire some of my colleagues as support staff, but that never went through. So, to me, what we're proposing here is a very mild and moderate proposal. But I do understand that issue could be a problem, I suppose, but it's one I look forward to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am supportive of the bill. When it first came out, though, I was rather surprised, because in the White Bear schools, we've had a school choice school within a school for almost 30 years, and it's still thriving today, and I was just really surprised that others aren't doing this, because it is possible already. Maybe this is something that starts the conversation over and continues it to go. What I did want to ask was, I know in the line 2.11 you talk about determining the budget and the allocation, and then in 3.3 you talk about the administration fees, and wearing my former school board hat, I'm just curious, you know, who's going to pay for, like, the building maintenance, the support staff, the utilities, and things like that? If you say that we're going to have the same flexibility as charter schools, is there going to be proportionate amounts for that?
Mr. Johnson, maybe you would answer the second question, but before you did, just a quick response to your preface there.
You'll need to be quick.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The purpose of this bill is to enable districts throughout the state to do exactly what White Bear Lake is doing and what other districts in Mankato is doing and what, from time to time, the Gina Schools was doing. And so this is to put this down in statute so that everybody understands the parameters in which this new opportunity can exist. So you should be pleased, probably because you were on the school board, that district has those opportunities. But I want it for all districts.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative, very quickly, in earlier versions of this bill, if any of you saw those, there were specific numbers here. And when you start putting a specific number and say it's going to apply to every school situation all over the state, you invite a lot of argument. So we thought, why not just simply force an agreement between the school board and the new school to find a figure that is fair and right? And I would say just quickly in response to Representative Loon's comments that, yes, if you unleash innovation, you might get some unintended consequences, but the board in its request for proposals could actually try to anticipate some of those. But it's a high-class problem if you have all kinds of enthusiasm for these new schools. And over time, some of us think at least that this is the mechanism by which we will replace the schools that don't do as well.
We have three questions on the left, Representative Faust, Representative Peterson, and Representative Katz. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to make it short. I certainly like this better than your local equity index, Representative Benson.
Well, you'll like the location equity index better after more thoroughly.
I understand how this can work in districts that have multiple elementary or multiple high schools in one district. I see how that can work. But out in my area where all of my schools have, you know, basically one elementary school and then maybe a high school, but it's just one of each in each district. What is the disadvantage to them to just say, well, we'll just do this for all of our schools so that we don't have to follow any of these extra rules that our charter schools don't have to follow? And in which case, if that's the case, why don't we just get rid of all of those rules that the schools have to follow other than the charter schools? And, you know, I mean, if it's that easy for them to switch over and get away from those rules, why are they even there in the first place?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Faust, first of all, it isn't always easy to switch over. You have to have a willing cadre of teachers, first of all, and you may have 3-4 teachers within one building who are interested in proposing a new change. We, in Edina, for example, three of my colleagues and myself have proposed a 3-year school within the school, heterogeneously selected students, and the parents could opt in and opt out. And we thought that would create great accountability, because if I taught the same kids in multiple subjects for 3 years and they still knew nothing and they still did poorly on a norm test, there would be a real accountability there. That didn't come about. But there are all kinds of permutations that can take place, even, and especially, I think, for a Greater Minnesota school that is under pressure because of the declining enrollment and students going to another district, this is an opportunity for them to provide some new teaching methods and opportunities to retain those kids and maybe drop some back who have left. So I see it as a win-win.
Members, we have about 3 minutes left. Representative Faust, do you wish to follow up?
I'll talk to Ben.
Members, we have about 3 minutes left. We still have three members who have questions. That will put us beyond our time. I want to get a sense of the committee. I'm willing to do whatever the committee wants to do here. We can certainly move for a vote, but, you know, it is a new idea to some degree, and I think it's important that if we're going to act on this, that the committee have fully informed ownership of the issue. We can certainly carry this over for later in the week. Of course, tomorrow we're hearing, we're picking up the beginning of shaping up the policy. On the policy bill, we'll be taking up the chair's delete all amendment, which will be quite comprehensive. We'll spend tomorrow vetting that through. And then on Thursday, we'll be entertaining amendments to the new bill, if you will, before us, and we do have Friday scheduled. At this point, I have only one bill scheduled for Friday morning, but we certainly still do have time this week to continue our work. And so I just want to get a quick sense from the committee on how you would wish to see Representative Dornan.
I think we're all ready to vote.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just like to request that we do have a vote, and I'd just like to remind my colleagues on the committee that this bill will be going to finance and then after that to K-12 finance. And so if someone finds a terrible flaw or disaster aspect, we can amend and change and modify.
So, Benson, I have Representative Peterson, Representative Cass, and Representative Dietrich on the list. We're not going to be able to get to all three, so I would just... Well, there's one. Representative Peterson and Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question. On the word site-governed schools, does that allow the flexibility for a school to be started within a school?
Representative Benson.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Cass. This has been answered. Are there any other questions, observations? If not, Representative Benson then renews his motion that House File 751, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee for a re-referral to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Benson. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Johnson.
Mr.
Members, we are until tomorrow, 8:30. This committee stands adjourned.